Thomas Paine Podcast, number 27. We're shipping up to Boston today. Doing what Irishmen do, causing problems. Causing a lot of problems. This will be one to remember. Gonna remember this one. I'm up to no good. Believe me when I say it. Well, you don't have to believe me. You can just stick around for a little while. Landed an interview with these two Irish troublemakers, also known as the two investigators who have been probing the Clinton Foundation for the last 5 years. This is their first interview outside of a congressional hearing where they made their name, beating up on then-Congressman Mark Meadows and some of the other clowns that were on his committee. Larry Doyle and John Moynihan. Mr. Doyle is a very successful Wall Street finance guy, and Mr. Moynihan is probably one of the brightest investigators in the country. Somebody you probably never heard of before this congressional hearing. It was all the way back in 2018, by the way, and they've been kind of underground working hard since then, but they took time out to sit down with me. I guess they like some of the work we've been doing, and there's a mutual respect there, and I know Mr. Moynihan from his days in the Drug Enforcement Administration. We won't go any further than that to say that. But I think we were originally supposed to just chat for a little while, and one thing led to another, and they started dropping bombs after bombs after bombs. So I said, we'll just keep rolling here, and I'm not going to fuck around too much with introductions and things like that. I think I'm just going to roll right into this thing on the big podcast on Wednesday here. Got more Pain in the Morning came out a few hours ago, and now this one's coming out on Wednesday, and there'll be some news developing from this, to say the least, as the week goes on True Pundit, as we pull some stories out of here in print. That's a fun thing. We can do a podcast, and we can also augment it with print stories. Folks who come on here usually get a double, triple bang for their buck and their time. We appreciate the folks out on patreon.com/truepundit. And subscribestar.com/truepundit who are really pulling the weight for us by chipping in and donating and supporting on what to contributing in to our efforts, underwriting our efforts. Also have some ads now on these podcasts. I sometimes I hear them, sometimes I don't. I don't know what's going on with those, so we remain in flux on the hosting and ad front. It's a work in progress, just like anything else that you start. To be honest with you, I didn't even anticipate being in this position until 2021. So we'll take it, but we're having growing pains, just like we did when we started True Pundit. It's difficult. When you launch these things on a shoestring, it's always difficult. You can't throw money at your problems. Some other rich guy's money, you can't do that. So we got to learn on the fly. That does make you more nimble, though. learning for yourself, doing things for yourself and learning on the fly. Some lessons some of these hobos in the street could learn. Marching around, everybody wants something for nothing. I'm not going to get bogged down with that stuff going on right now. Because we talked about that. We've talked about that every day. And last night on the patreon.com/truepundit and subscribestar.com/truepundit, we did the More Pain show, and we talk about that 2 hours, 3 hours, about things like that. So you can catch that show where we delve into that. This we're going to delve into this duo's work on the Clinton Foundation and the tax case that they have sitting in tax court right now against the Clinton Foundation. And he also dropped bombshells on Bill Gates and what I call a criminal charity cartel of all these menagerie of nonprofit and tax-exempt organizations run by really rich and famous people that are basically laundering money. We get into some interesting stuff about that, too, when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State and controlling the purse strings of certain groups under the umbrella of Secretary of State, and some of that money made it back to the Clinton Foundation. There's some shocking revelations coming your way, so... Again, we're breaking new ground here. The first interview these guys have done. Private guys. Irish guys from Boston. That's why we're shipping up to Boston, to cause some fucking trouble. And so, you know, it's a fantastic interview. And I was lucky to score it. And I'll count my blessings. Three Irish Catholic guys shooting the shit. and they've done their homework. Boy, they've done their homework. For 5 years, they've jetted all over the world dogging these people, putting this case together. And it's really something to see and something to listen to. Also, they break a pretty big scoop in here. I'm not going to detail it. I'm not going to tease it up front. Just otherwise to say that we'll be that will be leading on True Pundit later today, and I'm not going to. See, when you do your homework. Okay, this is how it works. When you do your homework, you come across a lot of information, and you just, people say, oh, how do you guys get all these stories and things like that? Well, you do your homework. You know the people to talk to, the right people, and things fall in place. Like I said, these are lessons these people, these vagrants in the street, these vagabonds could learn. Hard work. Instead of gimme, 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 you got to go out and you got to work and earn it. So, I think there's probably five big stories in this interview. For me, I think for most people, the revelations are astounding. And you'll see the depth of knowledge these two have amassed through hard work and talking with people. Mostly Humint, H-U-M-I-N-T, human intelligence, globe-trotting, and I don't mean to say that in a Playboy-esque manner, but a dogged investigator gumshoe manner, talking to people, figuring out what the hell went wrong, and how many people the Clintons have ripped off, and Bill Gates comes up frequently here, and also coronavirus. It's truly amazing interview. And again, I'm excited to have it and provide it to you folks first, just like we did with Bobby Kennedy Jr., just like we did with Dr. Judy Mikovits, targeting Fauci, Bobby Kennedy, RFK Jr. targeted Fauci, and then everybody said, "Oh, we got to get Bobby Kennedy Jr. on. He was on the Thomas Paine podcast." And then we did the same with Dr. Judy Mikovits, basically taking Fauci down. Is what we did through months of research, by the way, months. And then everybody said, "Oh, we have to get her on." You know, so I would anticipate. I don't know if these guys are a tough sell, though. I don't think you're going to have as much success. They're very discerning, as they should be. Let's jump right into it. Oh, you know what? I want to play those clips first from the 2018 congressional hearing. I got two clips. Let me play the first one here. This is John Moynihan in the first one. Actually, I think he leads off both, but we'll go with the first one.
So what we did is we sent our appeal in with a photocopy of the FBI and the IRS CID on their jackets removing boxes from the Clinton Foundation after they had brought a 757 down and taken all the materials out of the Clinton Foundation, Little Rock, Arkansas. We sent that with our appeal to demonstrate to the IRS that your letter coming from Atlanta doesn't reconcile with what's going on in Little Rock.
We asked you, what does that mean? And we asked you for a copy of that letter from the IRS. Mm-hmm. Why won't you give us a copy since you did receive a letter of preliminary denial?
Because we're in an appeal status right now.
You're appealing the denial.
Yeah, so they actually encourage you. They actually say in the letter, please submit an appeal. They actually ask you, please submit an appeal as if we're wrong. So what we did is we sent our appeal in with a photocopy of the FBI and the IRS CID on their jackets removing boxes from the Clinton Foundation after they had brought a 757 down and taken all the materials out of the Clinton Foundation, Little Rock, Arkansas. We sent that with our appeal to demonstrate to the IRS that your letter coming from Atlanta doesn't reconcile with what's going on in Little Rock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The chair recognizes himself. So I want to do a little follow-up here. So your conversations with the special agents in Little Rock, Arkansas, Mr. Doyle, was that you?
That was me.
All right. And so your conversations with them, they acknowledged they had received the pages of documents. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And did they acknowledge any work that they're doing with that, either directly or indirectly?
Did not comment.
So they just said thank you for the submission.
Well, I mean, it was a very cordial, professional conversation. I can't comment. Thank you very much. You know, we were very, very grateful for your efforts.
Then what makes you believe that there's a criminal investigation out of Little Rock then? If that's the extent of it.
I spoke to him twice. I spoke to him in August and then again in October.
All right. So what would make you think that there's a criminal investigation, Mr. Doyle? I mean, if it was just cordial, I mean, then why would you believe that there's...
Well, in the August conversation, he said this is an open and ongoing situation.
All right. So he said that this is an open and ongoing... situation? Investigation or situation? Or matter.
I apologize. Investigation.
All right. So it was an open and ongoing investigation that he couldn't comment on.
Yes.
So that would indeed indicate that there's an investigation.
And Chairman, look, I worked for the DEA. I do work all over the world in these cases still. The fact that they followed up with a second inquiry, not just, hey, thanks, don't let the door hit you on the way out, but then they follow up again. That's not the sign of a closed investigation.
I get that, Mr. Moynihan, but I can't take your experience at the DEA, and I appreciate the thought, but the other part of that is, Mr. Doyle, if they said there was an open and ongoing investigation, that's what you recall that they said?
That is what I recall to the best of my memory.
And so if indeed there's an open and ongoing investigation and you've given the information to them, why would the IRS not view that as substantial?
Well, that's...
Did they know that there was an open and ongoing investigation?
We sent a picture to the IRS.
I heard that.
Right, so they know. That some part of the IRS knows.
That in our appeal letter.
In your appeal.
To them.
All right.
And to that point, Congressman, the IRS individual was, I would say, more than mildly surprised at our interaction with the FBI.
All right. Why do you think Mr. Huber waited until November the 30th to call you about four letters that you had sent prior? Because you had sent one on the 14th, the 18th, the 29th. Those were in April, 29th of May, as I recall, and October the 10th or 12th, based on what I understand. Why did they wait until November 30th to give you a call?
We don't know.
Do you think it might have had to do with the fact that you're coming here to testify?
Well, I mean, that this testimony invitation just came recently. I don't know why.
They were fully aware because we had asked them to come and be a witness at this particular hearing, and then all of a sudden you get a phone call from Mr. Huber's, what, second in command? Is that correct?
I don't know if he's the second, but he was clearly an assistant U.S. attorney dealing directly with Mr. Huber.
So I find it just very coincidental that on November 30th, a few days before the hearing, after they had been noticed that we wanted them to come and testify, all of a sudden they would start following up. So, Mr. Doyle, what did they say about the documents that you had provided them? Did they have them all?
Congressman, he said that we are reviewing your material. I asked him if he could comment if further beyond that, if this was open and ongoing. He said, we are reviewing your material. He called me back a few hours later, asked specifically about, you know, one exhibit, and then asked further if you could, you know, do you have these on a disk? I said, I have them on a thumb drive. Would you like them? Please resend them. So I resent the thumb drive that afternoon.
So was that the first time that Mr. Huber and his team actually got the documents from you, Mr. Doyle?
That was the third time.
Third time.
So you're telling me that on November 30th, they called you back and they couldn't find the first two submissions that you had made to the Department of Justice and Mr. Huber, that they wanted you to send them again?
Is that what
you're telling me?
We're concluding that ourselves. That's what we concluded.
And it was just what I've been told by DOJ, which I do not believe, just to be frank, is that this was the normal process of following up on recent correspondence.
Yes. Right.
And so they didn't respond to your April 4th letter. They didn't respond to the letter later in April. They didn't respond to the May 29th letter. And they finally responded to your October 10th letter a few days before a hearing that was coming up.
Correct.
That is correct.
Do you think that shows the level of interest that a special prosecutor would show?
We don't know his caseload, but quite frankly, we're disappointed that 3 years' level of effort goes into this. We are not paparazzi. We are not the media. We don't want anybody to even know who we are and the work that we do. We're financial investigators. That's what we do. We get paid to do this for a living. We work for ourselves. We don't get paid by anybody else.
And Congressman,
so it's disappointing that it took that long to hear from them.
We shared our materials not only with the attorney office in Salt Lake, also in Little Rock, but other U.S. attorneys' offices as well that had been indicated as, you know, providing support or working on Clinton-related matters. We also shared our materials with the U.S. Postal Inspection Service. So various jurisdictions that we felt would be interested both at the state and federal level.
Right.
And you've shared all of those documents with those entities, and yet you somehow do not believe that you should share it with Congress and the American people?
Well,
this yeah, answer year, that one for me, Mr. Monahan.
I'll answer it.
I want to hear this because, quite frankly,
are you going to prosecute the Clintons? Are you going to bring an action against the Clintons that would yield us economic consortium? I don't think you are. Those entities.
But I thought, hold on to your testimony. Don't get cute with me because I promise
I'm
you.
I'm telling you the truth.
I promise you. I thought you said you were all about the rule of law. That was in your opening statement. We all are, about justice and truth.
And that's why we've presented to the law enforcement agencies, which you're not.
Mr. Moynihan, let me just say this. We have an oversight responsibility. And I can assure you that when you come in here, it is incumbent upon you to be open and transparent. Mm-hmm. And we can make criminal referrals just like anybody else. Now, we cannot prosecute. You're exactly right. But what I can tell you is this, is that when you come before us and you've shared it with all kinds of entities and to not actually listen to my good friend to my right here and say, you deserve to see the same evidence that we've shared with others, I don't find how that actually provides a good foundation for truth and transparency.
It's just, I think we're looking at this from completely different perspectives. We are financial investigators. We do cases. We present our evidence to those jurisdictions, in this case, the IRS, that would bring a case. That's not what you do. So that's why we present it to them and not to you.
Okay. Well, I can assure you that we do have something here that will compel us to get the information, either from you or from the agencies.
Sure.
And I can assure you that we will, so that my good friend to my right and the entire committee can review these documents and make their own claim.
We welcome that from you.
Final question. Mr. Doyle, you said anywhere from $400 million to $2.5 billion might be subject to taxation, were improperly used in a charitable foundation named the Clinton Foundation. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And it could be all of it.
It could be all of it.
All right. If there's no further business before the committees, the committee stands adjourned.
Meadows. I feel bad for Doyle and Moynihan. It's like trying to explain something to a piece of sheetrock. It's Meadows. I mean, he sounds great on Fox News and everything. Now he's the chief of staff in the White House. Lord help us. I mean, maybe it doesn't come through to other people listening to that, but this guy's a U.S. congressman. I always find myself asking that question. This guy's a U.S. congressman, and he doesn't understand. He could have gotten the documents very simply without trying to make a public spectacle of it and getting his ass whooped. He got wrecked on national TV. Meadows, they drug Moynihan. And Doyle drummed him right out of Congress. And Jesus, God, it's embarrassing. He could have gotten it for you. I'm not going to go into that. It's, if you're a congressman and you don't understand what you can do to get the documents from these guys legally, you shouldn't be a congressman. We'll leave it at that. Anyway, let's talk to these guys. Let's have some sensible discussion with these guys like adults, not like what we just heard. It was like the adult table versus the kiddie table at Thanksgiving. And Meadows got hit in the head with a roll, dinner roll. You guys want to focus? You want to talk about Gates? What do you want to talk about?
There's plenty to talk about. I mean, we can, in terms of like who are some of their partners, who are some of the other, the drug companies, flows of funds. I mean, Geneva with some of that, donors. You know, some of the background work that we did looking into their 990s, the state registrations. I mean, the interviews.
Okay.
There's no shortage of topics.
Well, we'll just, whatever you guys want to talk about, whatever you guys want to roll things into, I'm flexible.
Mike, what's your goal of interviewing? What's your goal? What do you want to do? Let's just hear what you want to do so that, you know, we're not media people, so what would have value to you for the show? What's the best thing?
I'm no different than you guys. I just want to cause trouble. You guys are just better at it, and you actually make money from it. I'm down here fucking eating ramen, pride noodles, causing trouble like a hooligan. That's all right. I can live with that.
All right. So how much time do you need? Like, how much tape or time do you actually need? Whatever.
We can go as long as you want. It doesn't matter. Usually I go like an hour or something like that, sometimes more. But okay. I understand, like, there's a lot of... I'm not constrained by time today, so I'm not. I don't want to go two or 3 hours and lose my mind. I know you don't want to either, because we can always have you guys back on.
Not an hour and go from there. I think a fundamental understanding of what we did would have value to the audience. Like, everybody's like fucking all over the place. Like, I think this kind of a story about how we even got to where we are, and then explain it, like all the people who we met with and talked to and who wanted to pay us, and this rigor, you know, how we even started this fucking thing, you know?
We ended up going down like 6 or 7 or 8 different paths. We just keep going down, and then there are shoots off each of those paths. You know, right. All of these become very interesting and riveting stories in and of themselves, but then when you put the whole thing together, it's like, wow, you know, a lot going on here.
I think if there's any value to us doing this and then coming back again or something, I think everybody should have the same foundation. I think people should understand, like, what happened? How do we even get to where we are? And I think we got to talk about that. I mean,
okay,
just talk about
Kind of go back to the beginning, which was late 2015.
Yeah,
it was a year before the election even happened, and we started working on this.
So, yeah, just talk about any one of these things out of the blue. There'd be no context. Like, what the fuck are these guys talking?
Well, you know? We'll start then, and don't worry about intros. I'll do the intros before you guys come on. So, we'll do all that stuff. So I'll set it up so we don't have to waste time with that. So take me back to when this all started, so people can have a background of exactly ground zero, so to speak, when you got involved in this menagerie. It's turned into a menagerie, watching it unfold on... You guys were last seen beating up on then-Congressman Mark Meadows. the poor guy, after that hearing, he had to quit Congress.
That's something we can touch on here. With you're just talking about the hearing itself, and you know,
yeah,
some of the stuff that went into it, and then coming out of it, and during that hearing, when we took the little sidebar, you know, like, you're not getting the documents.
Yeah, I have to be honest with you. I didn't know you guys were testifying, and I I got a message that says, "Yeah, John Moynihan is on C-SPAN." So I turned it on. I said. And I was watching a little bit of it, and then I got sidetracked, and I said to myself, oh, man, Meadows is in for a long day. I said, you don't know this guy.
That was an interesting day.
Yeah. I mean, Moynihan's kind of like I've talked about it before, like just briefly on podcasts. I used to run around with the guys that John was a supervisor of in DEA. Way back in the day, who knows, whoever thought that we'd end up, either one of us would end up where we are and stuff. So John was like he was like a feared guy. His group was like, we don't want to make this guy angry. We were out in New York City causing all kind of trouble. So it's just funny that our paths have crossed again, so to speak.
Circle, and there he is again.
Yeah.
So, in any event, wait, do you want to take it out? I mean, late 2015?
Mike, I think what's important is sort of the foundation to any house, the house we're building. And that foundation, you know, dates back several years before my dear friend and partner Larry here and I engaged in filing a whistleblower case on a tax-exempt organization to the IRS in Ogden, Utah, August 1st, 2017. Previous to that, we had been solicited by a number of different people. We met with them, people from, you know, very high profile and wealthy people who are across the nation who really were looking to get to the bottom line of what all this Clinton Foundation was about. And Larry and I didn't know anything about the Clinton Foundation other than what we read in the paper too, and really had no reason to. So none of this is personal. I personally don't know the Clintons. I've never met them. They may be nice people. I have no idea. I've never met them. But they may not be nice people. I have no idea. But what we do is make cases. And, you know, what happens is, these folks are all reaching out to us and saying, hey, can you guys look into this? And we get in a plane and we traveled around the country, and Larry and I came back and said, the level of interest is astounding. People want to pay us to do this. And we got back and said, you know what? Enough. Enough with all these people. You know, they all want to know, and they have different angles and this and that. We're both independent voters. You know, why don't we just look at this thing ourselves? So Larry and I make a commitment. Let's look at this thing ourselves, and we say we'll put up our own money to travel or do whatever. And that's exactly what we did. So we start out of our own interest in self-funding. And it's always been that way. We've never had anybody fund us, and every dime of that that's spent on this is us. What is going on here? And so we start to really develop information. Go ahead, Larry, you can jump in. You know?
Yeah, the Clinton Cash Book written by Peter Schweitzer had come out in May of 2015. Hillary Clinton had, announced that she'd be running for presidency in 2016. There were lots of unknowns, right? Who was going to win the presidential election? Big unknown. And I guess we start looking into this. If she ends up winning the election, I mean, said, okay, we'll put a year's worth of work into it, and it will be for naught, because if she's the president, nobody's going to, you know, give this the time of day. But it was very methodical. We opened up some spreadsheets and developed some, and look, literally, if you look into a 990, a tax return that any not-for-profit has to file, a 990, I mean, they've got the income statements, but then there are about, 10 to 12 different schedules. Schedule B is a listing of all the major donations. And so we start looking into literally every schedule and then reconciling them, because each piece of information is like a clue. And you start developing here we are, cripes, going almost 5 years now, and we realize, like, oh my God, this is an 8,000-piece puzzle that, back 5 years ago, we had no idea that it was 8,000 pieces. But at the time, you just start laying out all these pieces, and you start connecting them, and each one says, okay, what did I learn, and where does it lead me, right? And you look at some of the donations, and then you say, okay, you go to their listing of donors that are on their website, and you try to reconcile things. And so you just start laying it out, and each becomes a path. And does it reconcile? Does it add up? You look at their net assets each year, and then you compare year by year, and you start just laying all this stuff out. in building these spreadsheets. And it was fascinating. I mean, it was fascinating. And so we go from their, all their federal forms to then we start soliciting in late 2016 into 2017 all the state registration forms that they filed. And just literally collecting endless amounts of information. I mean, we probably killed a lot of trees in terms of, you know, paper.
Right.
But you, again, looking at all the questions on the state registration forms, and realizing, oh, you know what? Early on in the life of this foundation, they were faced with some consent decrees in various states for not properly registering. Do they acknowledge that fact on other state registration forms? You say, oh, they're not acknowledging that, and that's stated under penalty of perjury. So these start to become, you know, what might initially be viewed as minor red flags. That when you see the repeated numbers, dozens upon dozens and then hundreds upon hundreds of times, becomes some major red flags. And as John knows better than me, you know, when people are loose with the truth, it leads to problems and further questions and inquiry. And so we just started, you know, literally going down all these different paths. And then you look into the foundation, you see some of their programs that they launched and the consortiums that they launched early on, and you try to reconcile that with their the statements that they filed with the IRS in terms of their, you know, initial articles of incorporation, the determination letters that they were receiving, what was on file at the National Archives. So everything gets cross-referenced 2, 3, 4 different times. What adds up? What doesn't add up leads to further questions. So this is, you know, just a multi-level pursuit. And what's interesting also, Michael, is that when you engage different people at different federal agencies or different states or also overseas, they're looking at this primarily from their perspective. You know, it's just straight on. We're looking at it from a 180-degree, if not actually a 360-degree perspective. And when you start getting into it and you realize we have more information than they do, and utilizing that approach to ask questions and to gather even more information, all done, no bias, just looking for the truth, you know, is there a case to be made? That's all it was. All part of this 8,000-piece puzzle that we're working on putting together, and we had the benefit of time. And, you know, and again, I don't want to go on too much, but then November 8th happened in 2016, and everything changed, right? Then our year's worth of effort was like, okay, game on. She didn't win. And, you know, we received a very interesting phone call the morning of November 9th. We had reached out in early October, a month before the election, to the CFO of the organization. And we've referenced this in our congressional hearing. That CFO, a fellow by the name of Andrew Kessel, was an acquaintance of mine from Wall Street. I figured, okay, you know what, cast the line. And then reaching out to Andy, left a message, pointedly made a point of telling him that I was working with John, because he might think, oh, what the heck is Larry Doyle, you know, an old Wall Street buddy, what's he calling me for, and just dismiss it.
Right.
But I made a point of putting John's name into the voicemail and including, you know, the firm that John had and the type of work in terms of investigative work, you know, an international money laundering expert, so that he could say, who is this guy, and go look him up. So that he could never come back and say, hey, these guys ticked me off. So that was, again, everything is above board and very straightforward. And at 9:45 on November 9th, you know, Andy's out in Little Rock, so it's 8:45. It had to have been one of his first phone calls. I think it's, who is it, Podesta? John Podesta gave the concession speech
for
Hillary Clinton, I think, the night before. That was only like 4 hours before that, right? 4 or 5 hours before that. I mean, had to have been one of the first phone calls that Andy Kessel made. Hey, Larry, how you know, and I was like, oh, interesting night. And he said, we'd love to get together. We've got, I'm working with John. We got people asking about what's going on with the foundation. We booked breakfast for November 30th at the Princeton Club in New York City. That was a very interesting breakfast.
So he right away, out of the chute, he's like, the day after the election, he was feeling a little nervous.
I mean, I was in my office, and, you know, I operating in about 2 to 3 hours of sleep. You want to get up and, you know, catching the morning news. And I looked in the window of my phone, and I remember thinking, like, oh, my God. You see Clinton Foundation pop up in the window of the phone. It's like, and you just realize, that guy, I got to be one of his first calls. And why would he call me one of the first calls? Well, let's put it this way. He had some things that he wanted to get off his chest. And we've testified under oath to the statements that he made. And he did, in terms of providing very incriminating material, in terms of how the foundation operated. And the mixing and matching of funds and the, expense abuse and the fact that, you know, he and others brought this to President Clinton's attention time and again. And, you know, there was no talking to him. This is private inurement, the abuse of charitable donations.
And his name is on a lot of the documents.
Andy's name is on most of the state registration forms and federal tax returns, all filed under penalty of perjury.
Well, we know he's lawyered up since the feds have talked to him. I mean, I know that much. I don't know if I'm sure you might be able to corroborate that or not, but
he's still at the foundation.
Yeah.
As we departed that morning, it was interesting. Andy said, you know what? Let's stay in touch. Do me a favor. Call me on my cell phone. Like, okay, thank you very much. And but he was we brought up the fact that there were some internal reviews that the foundation had undertaken on its own, both in late 2008 and then again in late 2011. And Andy acknowledged the fact that those internal reviews and, you know, our studying of those reviews, I mean, again, they were also very incriminating in terms of, before you do anything else, I mean, late 2008, the foundation's been in business for 10 years at that point. Their own lawyers are like, before you do anything else, you got to get in compliance with the law. You're not compliant. I mean, if that's not a damning statement, I don't know what is. It goes on to, you know, abuse, expense abuse, and all sorts of, you know, of other stuff. And then in 2011, nothing had changed. In indications that, you know, donors' expectations of quid pro quo, this is serious stuff. You have to assume that the people at the foundation figured those things would never see the light of day. But they did. Andy acknowledged those facts. There's a consistency throughout all our efforts. The federal returns, the state, the interviews, the documents that we sourced overseas, email exchanges that we sourced, conversations between foundation officials and foreign government officials. There's a consistency throughout this in terms of the abuse of the tax codes, various rules and regulations that the IRS imposes on charitable organizations. And there's just the way that I look at it, a brazen disregard. It was this, just like, you know what, we're going to run this operation however we want, figuring that nobody's ever going to seriously look into us. Well, guess what? Me and John, we seriously looked into them, and not our opinion, just the facts.
Let me ask John a question. John, you work Colombian cartel cases and stuff. You don't have to go into the specifics. I wouldn't put you on the spot, but I know some of the cases you guys worked on because I was running with those guys and things, and I'm still friends with a lot of those guys. We've been friends for a long time, going on 30 years, I guess, now. We're getting fucking old. Sure. How long into this did you start to realize this is being run like a cartel? I don't want to put words in your mouth. Would you consider it run like a cartel?
Well, it's a great question. Because once we sourced out the primary documents that, once again, are filed by the entity, not filed by us, filed by the entity, what you really look for is a footprint, right? So, you know, you and your wife get married and it's your first house. You need at least one bedroom, maybe two for visitors. So your footprint is smaller, right? Right. Then all of a sudden you start to have children and your footprint, you know, your family's growing. You need a bigger footprint, right? So the footprint really, from the analytics, gives you a better idea of the construct of the operation. So as your family grows, now we have grammar school and this one's going now, and then you got Little League and you got basketball games and you got all these activities, and now your footprint in relationships are growing bigger. But when you look at the source documents, we start to see the footprint. And those source documents are identifying, right, cash flow and expenses. And when you see the level of growth from the initiation of the approval for a library, you see certain levels of income. But as you see those levels of income grow, and you see the library completed, no different than your house and your family, those cash flows continue. The footprint is growing. So what are you doing with all this money? Okay. Like, where's it going? So it's at that point, when you compare it for your question, it really the analytics starts to make you think, oh, wait a minute, this is a much bigger operation than a library, a $35 million library. That's when your antenna goes up and say, wait a minute, let me go back to the other source documents. IRS application 1023 form. What did you apply for? And then you look at what's going on in the cash flows. What were you approved for? You go back and you look. Were you approved for 1231 XYZ? Well, just specifically, it becomes very granular. And when you hold true to the granular nature of what the application was made by the foundation, what the approval was by the IRS, you now have a playing field. And is that playing field reconciling with the footprint? Right? If you're a drug organization and you're running a coffee business, is the cash flows recognized? Is that reconciling to the footprint of the facilities you own? It's those disparities and those variations that really pique your curiosity. That's when you start to see a case. When we started to see the cash flows as large as they were, yet the approval was for a library, penalty flag. It's at that point you start to see there's something else going on here. There's something else going on here. You're not just producing coffee. Something else is going on here. You're not just funding a library because you already did that in the first couple of years. You already funded that. You put your 25% overhead allocation when it goes to NARA,
by National Archives, takes over all presidential libraries. That's transferred to the federal government. But the cash flows continue. What else is going on here? But to that point, in our analysis, that we know this has got to be reviewed. Why? Because you go back to the application, very granular, and the approval. Are you living within that? Having done so many cases of 501c3s across the country, this arena is an atrocity. The violations within the 501c3 arena are so bad. It is such an abuse of a privilege that's bestowed upon an applicant to get a tax advantage, which is subsidized by taxpayers. You have at least a federal, if you're producing revenue at the 35 to 39% taxable rate on top of state, maybe your city, that is the head start you get to these tax-exempt organizations. Okay? When you get that, you need to live within what the IRS has approved for you to live in. You live in that footprint. When we see revenues expanding well beyond that defined footprint, then we know there's a problem. When we saw the revenues that day, that's when we knew.
And Michael, I mean, just, again, kind of starting, going back to the early years, you know, as John states, this was commissioned to build a presidential library. But there were two huge developments, one in 2002 with the launch of a Geneva-based World Health Organization affiliate called the Global Fund for AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, which so happens that that Chelsea Clinton wrote both her thesis and then 10, 12 years later writes her dissertation on the Global Fund. So, you know, how about that? So the Global Fund for AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, funded by, you know, largely developed countries, the United States providing by charter a third of their funding. And that's over the course of the last 18 years, $60 billion. So the U.S. has been committed approximately $20 billion to that. That gets launched. And then shortly thereafter, George W. Bush, President Bush, announces a program under the USAID umbrella called PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. And that was going to be a huge money initiative. And there's been, you know, upwards of $60, $70 billion of U.S. government funds. So when we kind of lay out all these different puzzle pieces, I look at those as kind of like the right tackle and the left tackle. If we could use a football analogy. And all of a sudden you start seeing outfits like the Clinton Foundation and many others who are just like, you know what, we're just going to kind of ride the, you know, just get right behind these guys, you know, meaning the Global Fund and PEPFAR. And we're going to just kind of, you know, we're going to trail them. And so what's interesting about the Global Fund is, and as well as USAID, when Hillary Clinton becomes Secretary of State in 2009, USAID, you know, previously would report to an undersecretary and then the undersecretary to the Secretary of State. In 2009, USAID reported directly to Hillary Clinton with no IG in place. And we ran a review of all, through the State Department's FOIA website. Also of interest was the Global Fund during that time period was rocked with, you know, meaningful amounts of fraud, allegations of fraud, and we read all their IG reports. And so the State Department actually sent some folks over to Geneva. And what were they sent over there? to help them with the messaging around these frauds, because the donor countries, you know, Sweden and Norway, and like, what the hell is going on? So the State Department sends these people over not to find out what the heck is going on, but to help them with their messaging. And a Washington-based, you know, good government outfit called the Government Accountability Project, you know, draws up a letter and states unequivocally, you know, that the State Department was, you know, acting in a collusive, corrupt fashion with the Global Fund that, you know, cost American taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars. Again, these aren't our opinions. These are documented facts and documented evidence. We have those documents. So these are, again, when we talk about red flags, those are major red flags. Also in Geneva, along with the Global Fund, is another World Health Organization affiliate called UNITAID. And while, you know, many people are thinking, okay, you know, who's the biggest donor to the Clinton Foundation? Is it, you know, the Ukraine or, you know, different Qatar or Saudi Arabia? Actually, this outfit, UNITAID, which is, you know, kind of a mirror image of the Global Fund. Again, it provides financing for developing countries for pharmaceutical purposes. The Clinton Foundation is the largest recipient of UNITAID funds. UNITAID's about a $3 billion outfit. The Clinton Foundation has received $700 million. The most interesting thing, though, from our perspective about UNITAID, 70% of those funds don't come from, you know, the donor government. It actually comes from an airline tax. So if you're going through the airport in France or selected African nations or selected other, you know, nations around the world, you don't even realize it, but they, you know, UNITAID's got their hand in your pocket, and 70%, so it's like, okay, you know what? The Clinton Foundation received $700 million from UNITAID, 70%. So you could say half a billion dollars goes to the Clinton Foundation from consumer airline travelers. You know, dare I say, if some of the people wearing yellow vests over in France were fully aware of that, they might be sufficiently pissed off.
Well, just let me recap real quick, guys, because you guys have already put the puzzle pieces together. I understand how they're fitting now, but I just want to point out, so to the folks out there that don't have a background of chasing scoundrels for decades, you have UNITAID, you have the Global Fund, you have USAID, which is an arm of the United States, and they send money to these places overseas. And those places kick money to the Clinton Foundation. And this all goes on while Hillary Clinton is in charge of deciding how much money and what money goes where from USAID. So she's basically laundering money back into her foundation. And if, of course, it's more complicated than that, I think. When you look at USAID and then you look at other places like the CDC and we get into pharmaceuticals, it gets even more complicated about where the Clinton Foundation is getting their money from. And so it's a fancy scheme that probably nobody would even know about if it wasn't for you guys. Is that accurate? Is my assessment of that accurate?
You know, Mike, it's a matter of follow the money. You have recapped it. We have filed what amounts to a probable cause memo with the IRS, recapping what you just said. And that's exactly what we're doing. We're following that path of money. And the path of money has led us to really what we call an ecosystem of people all related to one another, not familial, but in terms of political relationships, people having worked for years within administrations together. And it's really very troubling. You hear a term called deep state all the time. I don't know if I'm right or wrong when I give my definition of it, but here's our definition of it. And what we're witnessing in that ecosystem is a deep state approach to the accumulation of tax dollars, either by avoiding paying tax, so you keep it, i.e. nonprofit, or, as you just described, once taxes are collected, a redistribution through the channels you just described of tax dollars, where members of the ecosystem that we've identified, we know they are, we've got their names, their numbers, we've got everything, are the beneficiaries of those collected tax dollars. It's kind of a bookended operation. You don't pay tax on one side, taxpayers do, and once you've collected taxpayers' dollars on the other side, there's a redistribution mechanism where it comes back to those same people who don't pay tax. You get it on both sides of the house. Very troubling. We've identified this throughout the 501c3 arena. This case we have filed has, as you know better than us, taken to the attention of people within the government. And maybe you can even talk to that better than we can. To the point where, if you look the case up, it's actually under seal. Which is extraordinary that a publicly supported nonprofit entity and a case involving them is under seal. Why? There's nothing of personal tax returns. There's nothing personal about this. This is about an entity supported by the taxpayers. So that whole side of the case, we can't speak to. But the cash flow that you're talking about and what's going on within that cash flow is what leads to a case like this being under seal. It's extraordinary that this should be under seal, when the taxpayers are the ones who fund it, either through donation and or subsidy by not having to pay tax. So what one entity doesn't pay, if the government uses tax dollars, someone else has to pay. You're subsidizing them at the applicable federal and state tax rates.
Well, just real quick,
it's
John.
Extremely troubling.
John, just real quick. People out there saying, why can't we get all the details about these things? Why aren't Moynihan and Doyle talking about the details? You can't talk about the details because the folks who wanted it sealed, the folks who petitioned the court to seal it, is the IRS. They say, you got to lock this thing down. These guys filed this case. They have all these attachments. They have all these documents, tons of documentation. This can't be out in the public. We got to keep this quiet. So that's why it's sealed. It wasn't your choice. And two, then I'll let you guys talk. This is my style just to let people talk, but I just wanted to interject. I talked to guys in Justice, and they say DOJ is terrified of this case. The FBI and Treasury, the IRS, they had guys that wanted to work this case and did work the case. But a guy like Barr, everybody thinks Barr is this guy, you know, he's a white hat, all this stuff. His DOJ is terrified of the case. They want to keep a lid on this. They want to keep it sealed. They're happy to keep a lid on it. So that's the feel I'm getting. It was described to me by one guy who's a nuclear bomb.
Well, the multiplier on this is extraordinary, because having done some of these 501c3 cases, To me, that is the deep state. Larry and I have done the research. This sector of nonprofits, $1.9 with a T, trillion dollars a year in the United States, $1.9 trillion dollars a year flows through this sector untaxed. $1.9 trillion. It's extraordinary, which includes universities and this and that. And everybody wants to know why we're broke. If you're a college town, if you're a city in America that has colleges and universities, everybody applauds and claps their hands and says, isn't this great? Well, we see so many universities involved in that case, recipients of funds. So these universities have endowments. They don't pay tax on the interest that they earn. Those same universities are receiving grants of tax dollars. Those universities are paying no real estate tax. Even if they make a pilot payment in lieu of taxes, it's a percentage of what the rest of us are being taxed. And to cap it all off, after having paid no income tax, these folks ask for federal financial aid. They actually get financial aid as well. So when you look at those 5 points, all 501c3s, now you bring this to the Clinton Foundation and all these other foundations, $1.9 trillion, no tax, and everybody wants to know why the country's broke, that would be the 10th largest GDP unit in the world. In the world, that would be the 10th largest unit. We are watching chaos ensue in America right now. Okay? We need more money for this. We need more money for that. We need this. We need that. $1.9 trillion flows through this every year, and no one says anything about it. It's outrageous. That's the deep state.
Yeah, and Michael, I mean, just to be very specific, okay, we look at the consortium that the Clinton Foundation formed in late 2003. And who's in that consortium? Harvard University, Columbia University, Health Alliance International, which is affiliated with the University of Washington. Okay, and it's an outfit that led it, that implemented was the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, also a Boston-based initiative led by a fellow by the name of Donald Berwick, who worked in the Clinton administration.
Isn't that Cambridge, up in Cambridge?
Yeah, Cambridge, Boston, right. You know, back and forth. Pharmaceutical companies. Ranbaxy Labs, which ends up 10 years later in 2013, gets hit with 7 felony counts and a $500 million fine. Gilead Sciences, which has been highlighted recently for producing or getting attention to lead the vaccine effort for this coronavirus. So we look at these entities, and we see time and again that there are massive amounts of U.S. government funds. And really, what were the Clintons doing? And we laid it out both in the congressional hearing and in our submission. What they did was they were middlemen. They were agents. They were acting as agents or brokers of, you know, funds from whether it was the U.S. government, other foreign governments, these donors, and taking, you know, taking fees. And so monies were both coming and going, and they're, you know, right there in the middle. We're like, okay, fine. You know what? You got yourselves a real business here. Pay your tax. You know what? You got a $3 billion top line. Okay, it looks like you've got a 15% operating margin. Again, this is before we get into a more rigorous audit of their books. Like, okay, well, wait a second. you know, what to what degree were these expenses legit, you know, and it looked like there was a lot of algorithmic activity on some of their expenses when you look at line items, and it's like other, you know, representing 8 to 10%. Then you have other line items, all of it. I mean, literally on their 990s, other expenses, other. And then you go further down, all other expenses. It's just like, you know, come on, are you kidding me? But this is really what the Clintons, they utilize their position to, as an agent. And it was the sort of thing like, okay, there are plenty of people around the world. Let's get close to the Clintons. But over and above this, though, who was really even, what I would maintain, even above the Clintons, central to this entire, John was talking about this ecosystem or swamp or deep state or whatever, you know, smack in the middle of it was Bill Gates. I mean, he is all over this entire space. And he not only sits on the board of that Unitaid, heavily involved with the Global Fund, heavily involved with these pharmaceutical companies. And the fact is, these pharmaceutical companies, both Ranbaxy and also Gilead, they were distributing adulterated medicines. Adulterated medicines. I mean, in fact, an executive at Ranbaxy...
Tainted medicines. I'm talking about tainted medicines. Like, they're not real.
Tainted medicines. They have such little effect. And what happens is, it leads to significant levels of drug resistance. These are like ticking time bombs that they have sent across large parts of the developing world. And there was a quote from a Ranbaxy executive at a 2005 meeting that was sourced from a whistleblower at Ranbaxy by the name of Dinesh Thakur, and is highlighted not only in a Fortune article in 2013, but then also in a book called Bottle of Lies. And what did this executive at Ranbaxy say when the whistleblower said, hey, you know, we are putting out, you know, adulterated meds, bad data behind these. This executive said, and especially in light of everything that's going on in the country today, this Ranbaxy, who is a partner of the Clinton Foundation, states, who cares? It's just blacks dying. That's a quote that has never been denied and has been referenced many times, both in well-known periodicals and in this book, Bottle of Lies. So you know what? If anybody at the Clinton Foundation, you know, they should answer to that. How is it that you partnered with this an outfit that could do that? And why is it that the FDA, when presented with the information by this whistleblower in the 2006-2007 time period, in the DOJ, both the FDA and the DOJ dragged their feet. And we looked at all the actions that were brought against Ranbaxy every year. And it wasn't until 2013 that the DOJ finally said, you know, enough is enough. But the interesting thing about that case, That case finally, you know, went to court and was settled on May 13th, 2013. And your listeners would be very interested in knowing, okay, so May 13th, 2013, it was a Monday, and it was down in Maryland where that was, settlement occurred and judgment occurred. On that prior Friday, okay, May 10th, Lois Lerner, then the head of the IRS tax exempt group, takes a planted question at an IRS press conference regarding, you know, was the IRS targeting Tea Party groups? Becomes a major news event, right? Think that was conveniently planted to provide some cover for the Clinton Foundation so that they didn't get jammed up with their partners at Ranbaxy on Monday? We have detailed timelines. I mean, so the case that we've presented, you know, we put it in case format and then chronological format. And we literally go week by week, month by month. And you just look at the correlation between events and paints quite a story. But those two dates, May 10th, Lois Lerner takes the planted question 3 days before Ranbaxy pleads to 7 felonies. Pretty interesting stuff, right?
Well, don't forget, too, Dr. Deborah Birx, she was in a role with the CDC at the time, and she was allowing, you know, despite the fact that the FBI had raided Rambaxi's headquarters, and there was
right.
it was public information that there was a criminal probe. The government was still doing business with these guys and paying for the drugs and doling it out, doling out tainted and phony drugs and vaccines while the FBI was investigating the company for widespread fraud and money laundering. And Birx was rubber stamping that while the FBI
well,
was.
Larry, where else is Birx a member of? Where else?
Dr. Birx is on the board of the Global Fund. And,
yeah, it's insane. It's insane. What you're talking about is insane.
Again, what we see here is it's all the same organizations doing all the same stuff. And so Michael, we lay all this stuff out on these different whiteboards, and we've got cash flows and org charts and, you know, all this stuff. And we lay this out late 2018, going into the congressional hearing, and then coming out of the congressional hearing early 2019. And we've got, you know, these whiteboards with 15, actually more than that, probably 20, 25 different organizations and universities and drug companies. And it's like, okay, you know, this is a heck of a case. And then, you know, January of this year, like, yeah, there's this virus over in China. And you start hearing about World Health Organization. We see, okay, on our board, World Health and the World Health Affiliates, Global Fund, and Unitaid. It's like, okay, you know, that's interesting. And then, you know, Bill Gates starts to take center stage with the current, you know, coronavirus, and he's taking a lead role in terms of, okay, you know, these are the things that need to happen, and starts talking, we need a new global fund. We need a new global fund, you know, $2.5 trillion global fund. And it's like, oh, how about that? Interesting. I mean, this global fund is $60 billion, so now $2.5 trillion. Okay, and you see, okay, who's one of the lead drug companies, you know, being promoted for this a vaccine? Gilead Sciences. I'm like, oh, they're on our board too, for, you know, distributing adulterated meds going all the way back. Gilead and Ranbaxy had licensing agreements. And, you know, the Clinton Foundation, President Clinton goes out a month or so ago and says, you know, we've got to get involved with this contact tracing. And then all of a sudden, just a couple of weeks ago, okay, who's going to be the lead entity up in Massachusetts for contact tracing? An outfit called Partners in Health. Partners in Health, we blew the whistle on them in February of 2019. And so it's our board suddenly has come to life.
They're on the whiteboard.
They are on the whiteboard.
And I are watching the television going, wait a minute. We're involved in the JV game, right? The varsity game's going on right before. So we're like, stop it. Wait a minute. So Larry and I start to go back and start looking at, wait a minute here. Hold on a minute. Are these all the same companies? We go back. We're doing our research. These are the same people. Mr. Kim, who is the head of the World Bank, decides to leave the World Bank with his credentials, with his capabilities, with his contacts and what he's done. He could go anywhere in the world. Where does he end up? Right up here in Boston. Partners in Health. Who's one of the senior directors on the board of directors at the Partners in Health, Larry?
Chelsea Clinton.
But like, wait a minute. So let's take a look back. Has there ever been any time in history where this same group may have gotten together over this contact tracing, and what have you? Well, what do we find, Larry?
Well, in August of 2019, there was a conference held in Rwanda, sponsored by the Aspen Institute. And who was at that conference? Representatives of the Gates Foundation, representatives of Partners in Health, Congressman Bobby Rush of Illinois, And Congressman Rush just so happens to be the lead for a $100 billion legislative ask, H.R. 6666, on contact tracing. How convenient, huh?
So we're talking 4 months before the pandemic? These folks are all meeting in Rwanda? All the people who are getting the contracts are meeting in Rwanda 4 months before the pandemic? The timeline is not our opinion. These are the events that go on.
That's right.
Okay, let's take a step back.
Let me one other point, though, Michael, before that, because we've got other, you know, and Harvard University has obviously gotten jammed up because of this fellow Lieber, the Lieber Research Group Harvard. Harvard is on the board here as well. But there was one other very large so-called public charity, D.C.-based, the largest non-governmental recipient of funds from the Global Fund, called Population Services International, also a significant recipient of funds from USAID to the tune of approximately $900 million. And what business are they in? They're involved in for-profit, they basically are a for-profit abortion franchising entity in these developing countries. I mean, it's just like, are you kidding me? So what's part of the ask, this $2.5 trillion, you know, UN-sponsored World Health Organization-led ask? What did they come out with just a couple of weeks ago? They said, okay, amongst all the, you know, the need for this funds for the coronavirus and humanitarian support, one of the essential services here, folks, is abortion. You know, that's going to be part of the ask, too. And like, oh, how convenient. You know what? We got to get our, these folks from Population Services International involved as well. So it's just like, okay, you know what? Our whiteboard, it's not a close match with what's going on. It's basically an identical match with what's going on here currently.
It's extraordinary.
You just substitute HIV with coronavirus and timestamp it, you know, June of 2020. And we drew these boards late 2018 going into early 2019. It's like, wow.
So it's the same scheme. It's just a different.
Just a different virus. Although, your interview with Dr. Mikovits talked about the fact that in this virus, because what's the primary virus that, you know, the Clintons were involved in? It was HIV, primarily. You know, there was some malaria and tuberculosis as well, but they get a lot of their notoriety for HIV. What did Dr. Mikovits talk about and others, the fellow over in France, that there are HIV strains in this coronavirus?
Yeah, that's a fact that's gone unreported. Nobody in the mainstream media wants to touch out with a 10-foot pole. Let me take one step back, you guys, John and Larry. You talked about this. I just want to go back over the steps again. I'm doing my Lieutenant Columbo thing where I circle back and I sound like an idiot. Let's talk about this contact tracing powwow 4 months before the pandemic. Who Clinton was involved? Let's just spend a couple minutes on that and go back over that, because I don't want that to be. I think that's very important.
To the best of our knowledge, we're not aware that there were representatives of the Clinton Foundation at this conference. It was a conference held in Rwanda, sponsored by an outfit called the Aspen Institute. Some of the primary funders of the conference were the Gates Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation. Those are the two names that I recall. And, you know, they're talking about a whole host of issues, but it's, you know, dare I say, convenient that Gates representatives are there, representatives of Partners in Health that end up getting the lead up in Massachusetts on contact tracing, and Congressman Rush from Illinois, who's leading the proposed legislation to fund this contact tracing. that they all, you know, they all happen to conveniently be in Rwanda, Africa, you know, 3 to 4 months before this virus starts getting legs over in China.
So you're talking about, huh? You're talking about the fall 2019, like September?
No, the conference was held in Rwanda in August of 2019.
Jesus Christ. Contact tracing.
Let's talk to them about this, right?
The thing that jumps out at me is a guy like Mr. Kim, Mr. James Kim, he has a resume where he can go anywhere in the world. Head of the World Bank. He ends up at a not-for-profit 501c3 that virtually no one's ever heard of called Partners in Health in Boston, Mass. And the next thing you know, they're winning a contract for contact tracing. I don't think that's a coincidence.
Yeah, and Jim Kim is, he's going to be their point person in terms of engaging governors around the country. And he went to Partners in Health from the World Bank, I think it was January or February of 2019.
But didn't Partners
in Health... This is a globalist ideology.
Oh, completely.
It really is. It's about the way we as human beings from a population standpoint. Larry's talking about companies that are looking to buy for money out of this $2.5 trillion fund for population control. Obviously, Mr. Gates has been very involved in population control throughout the world, as Larry spoke to earlier. I don't know what contract tracing is about other than identification of population movement. I mean, this is a globalist, and they would believe themselves to be visionaries. This is a globalist mindset that the planet is being corrupted by people, and that this little cabal is going to take responsibility for it. It's just shocking, the level of vanity and egotistical views that are being espoused by these people. It's just outrageous.
And as John said, you know, their taxpayer dollars, whether it's, you know, the funding of UNITAID with these airline tax, U.S. taxpayer dollars through, you know, going into USAID and PEPFAR, $20 billion of U.S. taxpayer funds going to the global fund, only to have Hillary Clinton, you know, corrupting and colluding with the global fund. And actually, the Clinton Foundation was a subrecipient of global fund monies. I mean, so literally, while she's the Secretary of State, the Clinton Foundation is a subrecipient of global fund monies with no IG oversight. I mean, come on, are you kidding me? What was President Obama thinking? How did he allow her to be Secretary of State in charge of USAID with no IG oversight? I mean, you want to talk about red flags? Those are major red flags. So, I mean, and here we are, a couple of private, you know, Irish guys out of, you know, Massachusetts who dig into it. And we've got, you know, hundreds of documents, both in case format and chronological format, and nothing is inconsistent here. And all this, Michael, was corroborated by people whom we interviewed, both currently working or formerly working at the foundation. So it's not like, okay, well, everything fits, but this doesn't fit. It all fits.
And so you've, you know, got what?
We haven't got everything. We've got it, but we've got enough.
So there's a multiplier here that our case, we were initially denied, which we spoke to in Congress by the IRS, that they would not investigate. And they list a variety of sort of boilerplate reasons. Either we don't have enough resources, or there's
you know, a timing issue, or, you know, there's some boilerplate reasons on sort of a form letter they send you. But sort of the reality of this situation is, for all of those large-scale donors that donate to the fund, and Larry can give you some numbers on how that shakes out, but in the event that our case moves forward and the activities of the foundation are deemed not to be illegal, we've never alleged that. What we're saying is they're taxable. All we're saying is those activities they did were taxable. Our case is nothing more than that. It's taxable. And they are by the Internal Revenue Code. They're just taxable. We ran our case by brilliant tax minds, brilliant masters in taxation, lawyers, accountants, financial analysts. Really, all they do for work, unanimously, every single one of them who reviewed it. And I'll tell you this, every single person we brought it to was a Democrat. Every single one. 100%. Not one of them would be deemed conservative. Every single one of them said unanimously, the consensus, you got to pay tax on what they're doing. You're an agent. You have to pay tax. That's all we're saying. We follow the cash flows to this whole living ecosystem that we're watching on TV every day, because Larry and I actually have the program with the uniforms and the numbers. We know all these guys. Because we've been working on it for the last 5 years. We just didn't know they were going to show up on the TV with a coronavirus. But the bottom line is, the folks that reviewed this in consensus form, brilliant tax attorneys, every single one of them, because you got to pay tax. The implication of that is anybody who was participatory in these activities that knew what was going on, who donated to the foundation, now runs the risk that if they knew what they were doing with the money, they too will have a tax consequence. Those who are unknown, less intimately involved, likely would not have a tax event. But those involved, i.e. a Bill Gates or anybody at that level who are intimately involved, there's a multiplier here, right? You now can't take those donated monies as a tax deduction. You're now going to pay tax on all that, because you're going to have to restate the $200, $300, $400 million all these people were given on your returns, and you got to pay tax. Because in a tax fraud, there's no statute of limitations in fraud.
So you're looking at like a 40% clawback or something like that, right?
Exactly right.
Yeah. And the Gates Foundation.
Saying,
go ahead. Wait,
exactly. We all have to pay. If you're going to give away $1.9 trillion a year to no tax, and that's obviously the legislature who does that, the Congress, then just follow the rules. All we're saying is follow the rules. And what went on here doesn't fit in those rules. It's just that simple. We're not saying anything bad about anybody, Mike. We're saying what you did is our taxable events. They're not illegal. They're taxable events. So just pay your tax.
Yeah. I mean, it's IRS code 170C2. 170C2. I mean, acting as an agent. I mean, somebody acting as an agent of a foreign government or a foreign corporation is supposed to register under the Foreign Agent Registration Act. But if you're acting as an agent, that is categorically not a tax-exempt activity. So, you know, the Clinton Foundation, which has the, you know, top line revenue of $3 billion. Okay. You know, even if we were generous in stating, okay, well, we'll grant you, you know, some significant level of, you know, approval with meaningful amounts of your expenses, they're still likely going to face, you know, well, whatever. I don't want to get into conjecture. but they would be facing, you know, a multiple $100 million tax bill. The Gates Foundation has donated $370 million to the Clintons. So if you want to throw 40% on that, they're facing, you know, $140 million. This is real money, but there's clear abuse. There is clear, this is not like, well, you know, me. No, no, no. This is so overwhelming, and it's consistent. You know, the foundation officials told us their own internal reviews. I mean, the Simpson Thatcher even stated that the Clinton Foundation board was not even involved with some of their major program initiatives. They're just doing this, you know, without. So that's why we said that they've run this like a closely held family partnership for their own benefit. She was never going to lose, right? And nobody was ever going to know.
Well, Mike, if we asked you, how many of these nonprofits do you think exist in the country right now? IRS-approved nonprofits. What do you think, Mike? How many do you think your readers think exist out there?
Well, I just want to interject one thing in that I'm more interested in how many grifters saw that the Clintons were getting away with this and the word got out on the street in the circles of the rich and famous. Hey, you got to get your own foundation. You can rip the shit out of everybody. And so I look at maybe like the Clinton Foundation as the granddaddy, and all these people in the network said, hey, we got to get our own foundation. These guys are getting away with murder. But
on that point, Mike,
yeah,
I actually don't know that the Clinton Foundation is the granddaddy. They're one of them with a big ecosystem attached to them. There are over 1,800,000 of these that have been approved in the last 20 years in this country.
That's insane.
Okay? 1,800,000.
And that's a 250% increase. 250% increase.
Who in the name of God is going to oversee that? How is it even possible to monitor that? It's not. So we see our ecosystem and how they all know each other and have all fed off of each other, and it's alive and living, and now we have contact tracing and all of this, the $2.5 trillion, all that. We have no idea of that 1.8 million of these, how many more ecosystems exist. Could be in pharmaceuticals, could be in, you know, manufacturing and automobiles. We have no idea. I mean, we have no idea. We are locked onto this one. But the bigger question is, when you have $1.9 trillion flowing through this, and this country is broke, people are rioting in the streets, the place is imploding, and all of these guys don't have to pay anything?
That's where I think of, you know, if you ever have to bring an exterminator into your house, does the guy come out of the basement or the crawl space or whatever and say that he just found just one mouse? Of course not. There's always more than one, you know. And so that sort of growth in that space, to me, I referenced this at that congressional hearing. It looks like the explosion of the subprime mortgage market that just exploded. Everybody's got to get involved in it because, again, a lack of, you know, meaningful regulatory oversight. And what happens? Bad practices and abuse, waste, fraud, abuse, corruption, because, you know, who's minding the store? Michael, also, your listeners would probably be interested. There are approximately 330,000 donors to the Clinton Foundation. But we made a point at the hearing that it's approximately 0.1%. So, you know, about 3,000 donors represents north of 80% of the money. So this is really, it's very concentrated in terms of where the real money, and when you look at it, actually a third of the Clinton Foundation revenues, and we should say that have been reported, because we don't know. We don't know if there's, you know, money that hasn't been reported, but a third of what has been reported comes from Unitaid and the Gates Foundation. Unitaid, $700 million. The Gates Foundation, $370 million. So there's, you know, $1.07 billion right there between two donors. You know what? Bill Gates get his checkbook out, and he's going to have to write a check to the American taxpayers for, you know, $100+ million.
Well, real quick, just to circle back, because it's something that stuck out in my head. We're talking about partners in health. Didn't they get money from USAID and the Global Fund and Unitaid when Clinton was Secretary of State?
Oh, yes. All the money, you know, coming and going. And, yes, they all received money from USAID and the Global Fund.
Was that when Hillary was Secretary of State?
That's how they made the board.
And what's interesting, who became the primary recipient of Global Fund money in the government of Haiti shortly after the earthquake? Population Services International. They changed the primary recipient of funds from the Global Fund going into Haiti from a local entity, and in comes Population Services International. The CEO of that company formerly was in the Clinton administration on the Council of Economic Advisors, and the chair of the board of Population Services International for an extended period until, you know, early last year was the head of USAID during the Clinton administration. So again, you know, it's all the same players, all the same roles. Who was the head of USAID while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State? A fellow who went there from the Gates Foundation. It's their club. We ain't in it. But you know what? It's our money, and we want it back. And that's we're bound and determined, and we're fighting for the American taxpayers.
Let me throw this in here real quick, because I think it's important. All these entities we're talking about, they've all been targets of criminal investigations as far as how it relates to this Clinton Foundation, okay? I know that the FBI looked at this. I know that other folks looked at this, other federal agents beside the FBI, right? So anything we're mentioning, they've already been looked at. And I know John talks about this being a tax case, and Larry, you talk about it too, being a tax case, straight up tax case. The problem is, for the feds, you can't look at this case and have documentation out there and exhibits and things like this that I would imagine are part of your case. I mean, I'm just going from history and from what I've heard from folks on the federal side. And it doesn't lay out a massive roadmap of fraud, criminality, and cartel-like behavior. So that's why it's under seal. And that's why they want to keep it under seal. And I'm curious to see where the hell this goes. Because you don't often hear from somebody in the DOJ when they say this is a nuclear bomb, they want to keep it under wraps. To me, that means exactly that. They want to keep it under wraps. I mean, I don't know if you're stuff is ever going to see the light of day.
Well, the thought that goes through my mind, and then I'll let Whitey comment, I think the American public, they're less concerned with, you know, some of the agencies. I think they're primarily concerned with their tax dollars and the rule of law and people who would abuse the rule of law for their own personal benefit. America, and this is the ultimate bipartisan. This isn't right versus left. This is right versus wrong, and people are beyond fed up. I mean, pissed off doesn't even begin to define. And as John and I have stated, you know, many times, we've got the goods, and we're going to the mat, and we're playing to win for the American taxpayers. And that's just the way it's going to be.
Yeah, we're not, you know, everybody has their own form of protest, people in the streets, people doing this, people doing that. We're silent. We don't rant and rave. We don't
have pictures and all of this stuff. We're focused on the facts. And the facts are, if you're a conservative legislator and you're not for high taxation and reconciled budgets, well, you need to take a look at how the money that you've appropriated to USAID and all that's being spent. And if you're more on the liberal side of the house and, you know, you want more taxation, well, it isn't happening here. It's $1.9 trillion that's not being taxed. So when Harvard University has a $40 billion endowment, they don't pay tax. When they ask for $600-800 million a year in grants, they don't pay tax. When they ask for federal financial aid for their students, they don't pay tax. When donors give them money, right, they don't pay tax. Then they don't pay tax on their real estate. Every single college in this country is a for-profit entity, even though they're tax exempt. Every college president will tell you, if we don't turn a profit, we're going out of business. This is what's going on. This is why we're broke. And it's going to continue to happen. So Larry and I don't march in the streets. We're trying to win in the courthouse. That's our job. And we're in the U.S. tax court right now on appeal to the IRS ruling. It's sealed. We'll let the judge in that case make his decision. And whatever he decides, we will respect that, and then we'll move accordingly. But we're not stopping. I want everybody to know that's not happening. We're not beholden to anybody but ourselves and to U.S. taxpayers. We will fund this thing and keep going. We're not stopping. That's how we are reacting to what's happening.
That's right. And, Michael, I would like to interject. A few months ago, we actually did launch, I mean, because again, we're private guys. But a few months ago, you know, throughout 2019, we had that hearing in late 2018. And it's like, you know, throughout 2019, where are those guys? You know, what happened to those guys? We actually, I mean, some people are like, oh, did they get Arkansas-ed? Did they get whacked? And like, you know, we're pretty even keel guys. We're not nervous. I mean, some people, you know, when we referenced that we went to Holy Cross, oh, these guys got to be affiliated with the Vatican. And, like, you know, where did people get these ideas? We're just, you know, private guys that like to win. But we did launch a Twitter account. And people who want to follow, you know, different tweets that we put out.
Yeah, yeah. What is it?
Our Twitter handle is at LWDoyleUSA. Obviously, as John has mentioned, and we want to reiterate, our case is under seal. We're not going to do anything to jeopardize that. But there is stuff that we can share, and we welcome sharing. And basically, really, just to let the public know, you know, we're fighting for them. And because, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, they get up and it's like, okay, you know, who the hell's fighting for us? And, you know, how is it that, you know, Barack Obama leaves Washington, first thing he does, Obama Foundation. Paul Ryan leaves Washington, what does he do? Start a foundation. Joe Biden leaves office, what do you start? The Biden Foundation. I mean, enough is enough.
You guys have tripped. You guys are on, like you said, you're on a main vein here with these people. But, you know, I guess one of the thoughts I had during this conversation when I said Clinton Foundation was the granddaddy. I'm looking at Harvard. I mean, maybe Harvard is the blueprint here, you know, because they have a lot of dough. And
you know, I think there's a lot of blueprints. I think there's different industries. There may be the educational industry. There may be the pharmaceutical, which is what the Clinton Foundation thing is about. You jump from HIV to now coronavirus. I mean, let's be honest. People get burnt out with what's happening. You can only keep asking people for money so often for a particular cause. And I go like, oh, come on, stop it, enough. Now you need something new. We just see what's going on now as to something new. We see what went on in the in our Clinton Foundation case as a prediction model, really. And why do I say that? Because everybody called us before the 2.5 trillion got announced. They said, hey, what do you guys think? You had so many people from agencies and around the globe, foreign countries. What do you guys think? We said, well, we're seeing all the same actors. The next act is going to be a massive fund. 3 weeks later, it happened. Everybody calls us back and says, what are the Powerball numbers? They said, I'd love to know the Powerball numbers. I don't know what the hell the Powerball number is, but I'll tell you what that number is. That number is brilliant. Why? Because they need something new. You need something new. And that's exactly what's happened. So we'll be vigilant in our case. We're going to listen. We're going to wait for the judge. We hope the judge makes a ruling soon, and whatever he rules, we'll react accordingly.
Yeah, and one other comment, Michael. When we looked, okay, this virus starts hitting the states in whatever it was, late January into February, and in around April 1, we looked like, okay, what are the countries, and what are there, 190, 195 countries, 200 countries in the world, something like that?
Yeah, I was going to ask you this. I know exactly where you're going because this went through my head too, and I've talked about it before, and people think I'm fucking crazy. But I'm like, I'm not crazy because I put the time in to look at the map and to do things.
Well, so we're going the same place here.
So go ahead.
We looked at the top 20 countries that get hit with the virus, right? And there's an 80% correlation with the funders of the Global Fund. So you got 195 countries in the world. Okay, you look at the top 20, you know, you're talking Italy and obviously the United States and all these, you know, largely European countries.
Talking about white. These are white countries.
These are the countries that fund the Global Fund.
Right.
And this is where we... You know, Whitey and I looking at that like, wow, how about that, huh? And what happens 3 weeks? So we're like, okay, they're going for another Global Fund. And 3 weeks later, you know, there's Gates and his folks from World Health and UN. Hey, we need $2.5 trillion. How convenient.
Well, the scheme would be, correct me if I'm wrong, this is just my head or where I come from. The scheme would be we need to raise money now so that this doesn't spread into areas that aren't as wealthy. It doesn't spread into the Africa. It doesn't spread into other places where kids can be affected. That's why we need to raise this money and to try to stop the next wave of coronavirus. Wouldn't that be part of the scheme?
That's the storyline, to which my response would be, okay, let's dial it back. Let's go back to 2004, 2005, 2006. When some of your primary providers of medication for HIV, Ranbaxy and Gilead, were distributing adulterated medicines. And what happens? What's the effect when you distribute over a number of years adulterated meds? The people taking those develop with drug resistance. This is a huge problem. Okay, it's a ticking time bomb. When you're giving people adulterated meds, so it's ineffective, watered-down drugs, what happens? You know, the virus, the bacteria, whatever, either mutates or you don't kill it. It sticks with you, and that's what's gone on here. This massive problem of drug resistance, there were reports that came out in 2008 highlighting this, 2014, and then again in 2018. The government of the UK commissioned a report. And they're like, this is a massive, you know, ticking time bomb that will have enormous, you know, economic and demographic effects going forward in the developing world. And you know what? The people at the FDA, the people at PEPFAR, the people at the Gates Foundation, the people at the Clinton Foundation either knew or should have known what was going on. And you can't tell me that they didn't know, you know. There's no doubt because the FDA is hitting Ranbaxy, you know, with these annual, consent decrees and injunctions. Like, you know, you can't keep doing this. If there's one book that people want to read, is this huge topic now going on in the country on problems with the supply chain of pharmaceuticals, coming to our country from India and China. One book that people should read, written by a woman by the name of Catherine Eban. In fact, Michael, if you can get her as a guest, that would be a fabulous guest, called Bottle of Lies. In Bottle of Lies is the story of Ranbaxy. The primary source of information is the whistleblower Dinesh Thakur. It is a devastating read in terms of the supply chain and the incredible abuse in the supply chain of drugs. And this is what the Clinton Foundation, the Gates Foundation, and World Health were involved in distributing throughout the developing world. So you want to talk about racism? That's real racism.
And don't forget,
Larry, I was going to say, correct me if I'm wrong, as Gilead tries to step forward with remdesivir as some sort of panacea for this coronavirus, are they not the same company that the U.S. government is in an open litigation against for patent rights?
That is exactly right. That case was filed in late 2019, patent infringement. Gilead filed a counterclaim in late April. That's an ongoing case
in the federal courts.
That's right.
It's just all the same people, Mike.
And don't forget, the FBI looked at their relationship with Ranbaxy as well. So these guys were under the...
So basically, whether it's the DOJ, the FBI, the FDA, the IRS, these people need to do their job. That's basically what's going on. These people need to do their job, and they can't, you know, have this regulatory capture and protect these entities, whether they're tax exempt or private enterprises. You know, the public gets it. And you know what? We're just a couple of Irish guys, you know, willing to go to the mat for the American taxpayers, and we're not backing down.
We're not backing down. It's the space is too large, and the 501c3 space. This is a case with that specific, based upon their own documents that they filed. None of these are our documents. They're the foundation's documents. They're the ones who filed it. We wouldn't know anything about Gilead or Ranbaxy if it wasn't for what they filed. So we're just following what they filed. And they just need to pay tax. I mean, it's just that simple. It's, you know, we're not criminal investigators anymore. We don't have badges and guns and all that. We're just following the facts. And when we have a consensus amongst tax attorneys that say, yeah, you got to pay tax on this, then I don't know what the obstacles are. I don't know what, you know, is the holdup, to be quite frank. It is what it is.
You mean with your case? You mean with your case, right? And tax court.
Yeah. Well, you know, once again, it's obviously we have the coronavirus and all this going on, and the courts are closed and all this stuff. But the reality is, you know, we have that filed well before the coronavirus. So there's a lot to it, and the judge would certainly need to sift through it and take his time to get to the bottom line. But the American taxpayer needs these types of cases to be successful. It's $1.9 trillion, the 10th largest economic unit in the world, running through this country tax exempt. When you have endowments, $43 billion endowments, billions, earn 5% on that. So if you earn 5% on that, you make $2 billion a year, you don't pay tax on it. I mean, it's just crazy.
And Michael, while we've touched on a lot today, and again, our case is under seal, so we can't go there.
I welcome
sharing with your listeners that we never show all our cards.
Well, that's smart.
We're not allowed to.
Well, that's smart, and I think that's there's so many things running through my head, and I actually take notes when I talk to guests. And we can tackle this later. I've taken up enough of your time, and we could go on forever talking about this. So we'll have to split it up, and we'll do something in the future. But just one thing that jumps out at me with this new wrinkle with coronavirus and what looks like another round of charity schemes. The big difference it looks like to me is now Gates is finally not on the side where he gives money. He's on the side where he's going to get money. He's on the supply side of these vaccines, and that's scary.
Well, that's a big change. That's why I called the previous case the JV game. We're in the JV game. This is now the boxing game.
Right.
Some of the bigger players are now no longer donors, but they're going to be suppliers of medicines, which are paid for by the Global Fund, World Health Organization. These medical medicinal funds that all these countries donate to, that's the pot of gold that everybody is attaching to. And yes, so in this case, if you're a stockholder in a major company, pharmaceutical distributor, and an owner, that's where you're going for the funds, because this is such a global pandemic. That's where the source of funding will come from. Now you're on the recipient side.
And Michael, when President Trump announced, a week or so ago, that we were going to, discontinue the relationship and the funding of the World Health Organization, and obviously the World Health Organization, all these, global governments. But the World Health Organization, there's probably no single individual more prominently involved with that than Bill Gates. So when the president announces, we're going to discontinue, that was a headshot to Bill Gates. And Bill Gates is centrally involved in all of this, both from, a foundation standpoint, but then also, his investments that he's got in these different pharmaceutical companies as well. So to say that he's conflicted would be an understatement. But this stuff all needs to get played out. And we're kind of in the middle of it. And we look forward to our day in court and playing it out and laying this all out there, right?
Well, we'll have you guys back. When we have you back, hopefully there will have been some action one way or the other in the tax court. I know you guys aren't going to, regardless of what happens, you have options. I understand the mechanisms of the legal system, so I know you still have options. And it's actually your options might be better if the tax court tells you to take a hike. Your options might be better. You might have more leverage.
We're not stopping. We're going to play it out as the hands are played back to us. That's simple.
And we do have a number of other submissions. I mean, we talked about the Clinton Foundation, but we've got a number of other whistleblower submissions with open claims that remain in play as well. We're involved.
You guys are troublemakers. That's why I like you. You guys are Irish hooligans.
Michael, one final comment. I think it was December. It was 1773 when I think it was predominantly a bunch of Irish guys up in Boston that threw the tea overboard.
Yeah.
And, that wasn't all that far away from where, from Whitey and I, where we grew up. And here we are, almost 250 years later. And what was that all about? It was abuse of the tax code by, by the British. Yeah. And those guys in Boston were pissed off. Well, guess what? There are a couple other guys from Massachusetts also pissed off. I guess we're, taking the fight to them as well.
If there was whiskey on that ship, that never would have happened.
My last comment is, you see the current day activities and really what folks are asking for. The ask is equity. That's what they want. And you know what? Silently, we're asking for equity.
Yep.
If the rules say you got to pay tax, you just pay it. It's that simple. It's not really complicated.
Yep, that's right.
And that's it. So we're hoping that the judge and our judges have the opportunity to see that, and we'll respond accordingly. But thank you for your time, as always.
Michael, it's been a lot of fun.
Oh, guys, thanks. And we'll pick this up at a later date, and we'll see how things play out. So God bless, and thanks for the time.
at LW Doyle USA. Give us a follow.
See, Larry, you're getting good at this. You're working your plugs in. You're becoming a, becoming a pro.
Spread
man.
The word. Okay, Michael, thanks very much. This has
all
been
right,
fun.
Gentlemen. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Right, bye. I want to thank John Moynihan and Larry Doyle for taking the time to explain things in depth and really drop a lot of bombs and shine a lot of lights on what's going on here. This underbelly, $1.9 trillion underbelly in the U.S. And I don't think a lot of people understand what the hell's going on. We've only just scratched the surface. And I think it's important to frame this properly, too. These guys, I think, are the two most dangerous guys right now in and around Washington, D.C. I'll tell you why. I've never seen a case like this. Here's the genesis of this case. Okay. These guys file this stuff. They send everybody documents, documentation. It's really, so use a shotgun approach so they don't have to, they don't have to wait for one agency to do something. They just give it to everybody, see what happens. So these are the people that have run away from the case, literally run away and hid from the case. Jeff Sessions, Huber, the FBI, the IRS, various U.S. attorneys' offices, the U.S. Postal Inspection, Bill Barr. Barr said there's nothing here. Couldn't be further from the truth. Have to listen to my other podcast, I think episode 8. We go all the way back to episode 8 talking about this and so many other. It's all spread throughout the different episode 9. There's just so many episodes where this is spread. There's just so much evidence that they could have put the Clintons away and a lot of their friends like Bill Gates away for a long time. But these folks all ran away from. Oh, yeah. And by the way, like I said, Congress, too, they haven't done squat on this case. There's no criminal referrals, right? This is why Moynihan and Doyle were smart not to give these corruptocrats access to any documentation. They would just sell it out the back door and let everybody cover their own asses like a protection racket. And Moynihan's been around the block undressing and beating up U.S. attorneys in the Southern District of New York when he was running ops at DEA when I was over there running around with DEA guys. When I was working across the river in Hackensack and New York was part of my beat off and on whenever some shit went down. So the guy's a legend in DEA. And what he's done since is even bigger. So these dopes in Congress try to put a lasso around somebody that's for real. They get they get kicked off the it's like getting kicked off the pony at a birthday party. Anyway, I hope you learned as much as I did. We'll have to have those folks back on, of course, and we wish them best of luck in their endeavors. I think that they have certain powerful people boxed into a corner, and I'm curious to see how this plays out. You can benefit us again on True Pundit and also directly at patreon.com/TruePundit and subscribestar.com/TruePundit. And that goes a long way. It allows me to do these kind of things and bring these kind of folks to the forefront where they should be. You think these guys, Fox News, would ever have these guys on? Are you kidding me? People would get fired. It's just not going to happen. So we appreciate the support on those platforms, and it goes a long way in. You heard Mr. Doyle plugging his Twitter account. What is it? LW Doyle USA. I think so. I think that's it. If it's not, yeah, that's got to be it. Let me just double check because I don't want to sound like an idiot. Yeah, L.W. Doyle, USA. And the tag on that is FBH, Financial Bounty Hunters. Should be Clinton Financial Bounty Hunters. Informative stuff. And we'll be following up on some of that stuff with stories on True Pundit. We thank you for your time. This was a good one. Another good one. And God bless you. And we appreciate all the notes on my dog Sully. And thank you for everything. God bless you. And we'll see you tomorrow again on Pain in the Morning.